UMH Podcast, el campus sonoro de la Universidad Miguel Hernández.
Hi everyone, welcome back to A Taller Mountain. This is episode 13. I'm Natalia Hernandez, a teacher of English at the Official School of Languages in ELTE. Thank you for listening to this podcast about the work of women creators, women writers. A Taller Mountain has been born of the collaboration between the Official School's Media Center, Mediateca, and the UMH, Universidad Miguel Hernández. I really hope you enjoy spending this time together. Our podcast can be found on iVoox, please subscribe, and also on the websites of the Official School of Languages and UMH Radio. With us today, we have Nieves, a student of English at the School of Languages and a student of English Studies at UNED. But most importantly, a devoted reader and literature enthusiast, I can assure you. With her, we're going to talk about a great author, Edith Wharton. But today, we're doing something a bit special. Rather than discussing the author's work in general, we're going to focus on one of these writer's stories, Roman Fever, since Nieves and I are big fans of it. Aren't we, Nieves?
Oh, yes, we are. And I appreciate you, your invitation to come here, Natalia. Thank you so much. It is an exciting opportunity.
Okay. Let's all then get ready for our first section, A Woman's Life. Edith Jones, she got the surname Wharton after she got married, was born in New York City in 1862. She was an American novelist, short story writer, playwright, and designer. She belonged to the upper-class New York aristocracy, whose lives and morals she portrayed. From 1866 to 1872, the Jones family visited France, Italy, Germany, and Spain, where Edith became fluent in French, German, and Italian. While in Europe, she was educated by tutors and governesses. She rejected the standards of fashion and etiquette that were expected of young girls at the time, which were intended to allow women to marry well and to be put on display at balls and parties. She considered these fashions superficial and oppressive. Edith wanted more education than she received, so she read from her father's library and from the libraries of her father's friends. As a young child, Edith would invent stories to tell her family. She began writing poetry, and at age 15, her first published work appeared, a translation of a German poem. However, the work was not credited to her, as her family did not want her name to appear in print, since writing was not considered a proper occupation for a society woman of her time, and was published under the name of a family friend. By 1880, at the age of 18, lots of her poems had been published under a pseudonym. Despite these early successes, she was not encouraged by her family or her social circle, and though she continued to write, she did not publish anything more until 1889. She married in 1885 and began to build upon three interests: American houses, writing, and Italy. At age 23, Wharton married Edward Robbins Wharton, who was 12 years her senior. From a well-established Boston family, he was a sportsman and a gentleman of the same social class and shared her love of travel. They traveled abroad, mostly to Italy, but also to Paris and England. In 1902, Wharton designed The Mount, her estate in Lenox, Massachusetts, which survives today as an example of her design principles. Edith Wharton wrote several of her novels there, including The House of Mirth in 1905, the first of many chronicles of life in all New York. At the Mount, she entertained the cream of American literary society, including her close friend novelist Henry James. Wharton knew and followed the rules of her strict aristocratic world, but she also felt the presence of another, different world. This one held emotions and ideas. The conflict between the mannered world and the passionate, uncontrollable one would provide the central dynamic of her work. That tension is most beautifully and powerfully expressed in her two greatest novels about New York, The House of Mirth and The Age of Innocence. She wrote them at different times, and they show her changing views. She wrote The House of Mirth in 1905 when she was trapped in a degrading marriage to a husband who was mentally unstable and intellectually limited. Wharton knew that divorce was social suicide and saw no escape for herself. The House of Mirth reflects her rage and desperation. However, after the First World War, Wharton's view changed. In 1921, she was divorced and living in France. She was financially secure, respected, with a thriving social life. Realizing that it had vanished, she began to reflect on the New York of her childhood. The Age of Innocence is a true elegy, mournful and respectful. Wharton was living in Paris when the First World War broke out, and there she did remarkable charitable work. She opened a workroom for unemployed women where they would receive a meal and 1 franc per day in exchange for sewing. Throughout the war, she worked tirelessly for refugees, for the injured, the unemployed, and the displaced. She returned to the United States after the war, where she received an honorary doctorate degree from Yale University in 1923, but she died in France in 1937. Amongst the awards she received, there is the Pulitzer Prize in 1921 for literature, which she won for The Age of Innocence, making Wharton the first woman to win the award. She was nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1927, 1928, and 1930, but she never won it. So, Nieves, hi.
Hi, hello.
All right. I know firsthand that you love, well, rather than love, I'd say you are devoted to Edith Wharton's short story, Roman Fever. Could you summarize the plot of this short story for us, please?
Yes, of course. Roman Fever follows two wealthy American women, Grace Ashley and Alida Slade, who are sitting together on a terrace in Rome, overlooking the ruins at sunset. They've known each other for years and appear to be polite friends, but beneath the surface, there are a long story or rivalry, especially over a man named Delphine Slade, who married Alida.
All right. That's intriguing. And tell us, why do you love it so much?
Well, I do love this story because with unmatched and remarkable and astonished mastery, Edith Wharton resolves an entire plot with a single word.
I know. This is incredible, incredible. It's mind-blowing. But unfortunately, we can't say what that word is, can we?
No.
our listeners will have to read the story to find out. Nieves, women are central in Edith Wharton's work. Do you think she has contributed in some way to feminism?
Well, Edith Wharton wasn't a feminist activist in the modern sense, but her work quietly dismantles the social limits placed on women by exposing how those limits operate and why they cost. Yes, though not in an overt or ideological way, Edith Wharton didn't write manifestos, but she made women in her lives central at a time when they were often sidelined. Her stories show how marriage, class, and social convention restrict women's choices, and how intelligence or desire can become liability rather than freedoms. By making those constraints visible and by taking women's emotional and moral complexity seriously, Wharton contributes to feminism in a quiet but a powerful way.
Yeah, she does.
She doesn't idealize her female character, but that's part of her feminism. She insists they are fully human, not symbols or victims.
Yes. Look, social criticism is one of the main themes in Roman Fever. Could you dwell on this, please?
Sure. Wharton's social criticism in Roman Fever isn't delivered through commentary or judgment, but through exposure.
Yeah, I love how she does that.
Yes. She lets social codes reveal their own emptiness and cruelty. Roman Fever is a sharp piece of social criticism because it shows how a rigid upper class world trains people to value appearance over truth. Everything that matters, desire, jealousy, resentment, has to be disguised as good manners. Wharton exposes a society in which women are encouraged to complete silently, to suppress their emotion and to measure their worth through marriage and respectability. The result is a culture where damage is done politely and consequences unfold over decades. By placing this critic inside an elegant, almost static scene, Wharton makes the social rules themselves oppressive and faintly absurd.
Yes. Rivalry and envy are central in the story. How do you analyze this?
Well, Roman Fever really runs on a rivalry, and it focuses on how quiet and internal that envy is. Rivalry in Roman Fever isn't loud or dramatic. It is polite, restrained, and socially acceptable, which makes it more dangerous. Envy becomes something the women live with for decades, shaping their identities. And rivalry in Roman Fever is subtle and long-lasting. Grace and Alida aren't openly hostile. Their envy is buried under manners, social rules, and polite conversation. What Wharton shows is how women, limited by social expectation, are pushed into competing indirectly, often through men. By the end of the story, envy isn't just about a man. It's about who has lived more fully and who had the greater emotional power. Wharton suggests that envy survives precisely because it's never spoken until it suddenly is.
Yes. Well, I personally believe that patriarchy is at the heart of the idea that women should be rivals. It's a control tool. You know the old saying, divide and rule? Well, anyway, let's turn to a different question. I think that one very serious aspect of Wharton's work is its study of cruelty. And this is so present in Roman Fever. What do you make of this?
Well, that is a really perceptive angle because it moves beyond theme into moral text. Wharton's cruelty isn't sensational or violent. It is cold, calculated, and socially permissible. In Roman Fever, cruelty appears as something refined people can commit while remaining outwardly civilized. But cruelty is a central in Roman Fever. It's a very restrained kind of cruelty. Alida's fourth letter is an act meant to end our rival's future without appearing cruel at all.
Oh, so there's a letter in the story.
Yes, and it yes, it is, and it plays a key role in the story, as you know.
Yes.
You know well. What makes it disturbing that is carried out through intelligence, social knowledge, and self-control, the very traits that society rewards. Wharton suggests that in a world where women have limited power, cruelty becomes indirect, delayed, and psychological, and it can last a lifetime. The story implies that cruelty doesn't always destroy its victim.
Now, secrecy, the destructive power of secrets. We must talk about this, and at the same time, keep the ending a secret, since we can't make any spoilers about this secret word.
Yes.
Could you comment on this?
Yes, that's a lovely challenge and very Whartonian, actually. Thinking about secrecy without breaking it is the challenge, of course.
Yes.
In Roman fever, secrets don't just hide the past. They shape lives, relationships, and self-image over decades. The damage comes not from revelation, but from the long silence itself. Wharton shows that secrets don't fade with time. They harden, becoming a kind of emotional architecture.
That's true.
Yes. What is striking is that secrecy allows cruelty and rivalry to persist without ever being acknowledged, which makes it far more destructive than open conflict.
Yes.
By the end of the story, suggests that what matters most isn't the secret itself, but who controls it and for how long.
Well, I'm sure our listeners must be really curious now about this story. I hope they want to read it very soon. And we must also tackle the issue of her writing style, since I love the way she writes, her style, the narrative structure. It's outstanding, isn't it?
Sure. Wharton's brilliance lies in precision and restraint. Almost nothing happens, yet everything changes.
Mm.
The style mirrors the emotional lives of her characters.
Mm.
One of the remarkable things about Wharton writing is how controlled it is.
Mm.
The language is elegant, but never showy. And the structure is deceptively simple. Two women sitting and talking as the light fades in Rome. Yet, within that quiet frame, she builds extraordinary tension, meaning accumulates through small gestures, pauses, and half-spoken thoughts. The story feels almost static on the surface, but emotionally, it's constantly shifting. Wharton trusts the reader to notice what's not being said, and the restraint is what makes the final effect so powerful, you know.
Yes, I know. Yes, unfortunately, it's time we started wrapping up this interview, so I need to ask you two questions now. Here goes the first one. Is there a quote by Edith Wharton that resonates with you?
Well, difficult in this short story, but my choice, I think, is sharp, ironic, and quite lethal, as a poisoned dart.
Oh.
Yes, it's a part when Mrs. Slade says, and I was wondering, even so respectfully, you understand wondering how two such exemplary characters as you and Horace had managed to produce anything quite so dynamic.
Wow.
Well, yes.
Yeah, it's a poison dart.
Yeah, yes, it is. What I love about this line is how perfectly it captures Wharton's idea of civilized cruelty. On the surface, it sounds like a compliment, even admiration. But underneath, it is an insult disguised as wit. Mrs. Slade is really questioning how two dull, respectable people could produce such a vibrant daughter. It is the first moment where politeness becomes a weapon. That's why the line resonates with me. It shows how power operates through language. A single sentence can establish dominance, reopen all wounds, and set the emotional stakes for everything that follows.
Okay, my second question is, do you recommend reading her work, especially Roman Fever, to students of English or to anyone? And why?
Yes, absolutely, without hesitation. I would recommend Edith Wharton and Roman Fever in particular to students of English and to any reader, in fact. For students, it's a masterclass in style, structure, subtext. How much can be done with so little? How meaning lives in silence, implication and point of view? For general readers, it's simply gripping. It's short, elegant, and emotionally sharp, and it proves that a story written over a century ago can feel so modern. Roman Fever teaches you how to read and at the same time enjoy a story quiet, noiseless, calm, elegant, but with a million of subliminal messages.
Nieves, it's been such a pleasure to have you here, to listen to your voice, to your passion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to you, Natalia. It has been my pleasure.
All right, let's move on now to our next section, on screen. You must read Roman Fever, but I'd also encourage you to listen to a very special radio play that I found on Berkeley's Library Online. It is a dramatized version of Roman Fever, where actresses play the roles of the two main characters. I'll leave you the link on the description of this episode of A Tolle Mountain. You shouldn't miss it. You must visit edithwharton.org, a website where you can visit the Mount, the historic country estate designed and built in 1902 by Edith Wharton in Lennox. Now a National Historic Landmark, it serves as a cultural center, museum, and public park, representing the only full expression of Wharton's architectural and landscape design theories. There are three major film adaptations of Wharton's work. They are Martin Scorsese's The Age of Innocence, which you can watch on Netflix, Terence Davis's The House of Mirth, which you can watch for free on YouTube, and John Madden's Ethan Frome. These films are renowned for capturing the social constraints, romantic tensions, and lavish, rigid lifestyles of Gilded Age New York society. I'll also leave you the link to a fabulous dramatic reading of The Age of Innocence, that is, with actors playing the different parts again, which you can find on LibriVox.org. And now, before we go, it would be great, Nieves, if you could read Legacy to our listeners, the poem by Rupi Kaur, which inspired the name of this podcast. Will you do that for us, please?
Yes, of course, Natalia. Mm. I stand on the sacrifice of a million women before me, thinking what can I do to make this mountain taller so the women after me can see farther.
Nieves, thanks again. You've made this mountain taller today with us doing this podcast, and of course, our listeners too. You, all of us together, we are making this mountain taller. We now have to say goodbye. I hope you have enjoyed this episode, and I hope you tune in with us in about 4 weeks.
My first name.
You'll find the link to this podcast, as well as those links I mentioned on the section on screen, posted on the Instagram page of the Official School of Languages. Subscribe, please, to our program at Ola Mountain on iVoox. And do not forget to give us a like if you enjoyed it. It will also be available on the school's website and on UMH Radio's website. A huge thank you to Nieves for joining us and to the entire staff of UMH Radio. In the technical team today, Manuel Macia. Bye.
Bye bye. Thank you. And if you let me love.
UMH Podcast, el campus sonoro de la Universidad Miguel Hernández.